Scripture this morning will be from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 8 through 13. 1 Timothy 3, 8 through 13. Likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let these also first be tested, and let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be the husband of one wife, ruling their children in their own houses well. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus.
Good morning. We're continuing our series this morning on leadership in the church, shepherds after my own heart, taken from the Jeremiah passage we read in the first week. For those of you that are finding it excruciatingly dull, we're almost done, just this week and one more, and then we'll be through it. But hopefully it's been helpful and informative to you in thinking about it. It's the kind of thing that churches ignore to their own peril, because like it or not, leadership is essential to the life of the body. And so it's important that we do take time from time to time and look at it. We've been looking at elders and deacons mostly together. I haven't really even spent a lot of time distinguishing them in their capacities and their description, because I've been looking at kind of a bird's eye view of the kind of person described in each case. We're going to do that again today. I had the text for the deacons read as the scripture reading, but we're going to take some from the elder passage and some from the deacon passage. We're just looking for kind of some bird's eye view trends and themes that can help us. What kind of person is a leader, either in the shepherd capacity or in the servant capacity in the church? And then next week, we'll finish the whole series up, and we'll ask about what are these jobs and what do they do, and what are our responsibilities to them. That'll be next week. Today, you may remember from last week, we took the qualities and description of a elder or deacon, and we sorted out all the ones that were kind of obviously character-related from the ones that were related to family-type questions, which come up quite a lot. And so this week, we're going to do the other half. We didn't talk about any of the family-related stuff last week, so we're going to give an attempt to talk about it this week, and we're going to look at the leader's house, the leader's household, the leader's home, the leader's family, and why is that so important in this text? If you read it, it seems to come up again and again and again in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, that for some reason, Paul is given these instructions by the Spirit that in consideration of a leader, looking at his household is itself significant. Why might that be? And I want to give you just kind of a rationale for it first, and then we'll dive off into the tricky questions about the text. Why might it be that a leader's household would matter? And I suspect it has something to do with the fact that the best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. If you want to know what someone's going to do, you want to see what they have done. If you're in 1 Timothy, for example, in chapter 3, verse 10, it talks about the deacon specifically and says, let them first be tested. Why would it say something like that? Because we'd like to know how they're going to do in this job. But it turns out we can't see the future. We can, however, see the past. And so what we'd like to know before they take in leadership is how have they done in the past? Because that's what we like for any kind of job. Some of you may not know this grand fact, but I am one of the official plumbers at Frog Road Christian Camp with zero training whatsoever. How did I get that job? It wasn't by volunteering, I can promise you that. We were putting in a PEX line, and none of the guys on the board knew how to do PEX. And so I said, well, I'll look at a YouTube video and see how it's done. And I bought the little tool, and I got there, and crawled underneath one of the toilets to hook up the water line, and my father-in-law Craig and Van were there, and they watch while I do the little crimper tool, real complicated. You put the crimper tool, you squeeze, and it's done. And they said, good job, you're in charge of that now. Now, why didn't they put me in charge when I said, oh, I think I could handle it? because they wanted to see that it would actually work first. They were really not convinced that I had any ability to do that. They weren't wrong. They wanted to know, when Ben does this, is it going to leak? Past behavior becomes an indicator of future behavior. He did it that one time, it didn't leak. So now, you're going to do it from now on, because it seems like it doesn't leak when you do it. So when you're going to pick somebody out for church leadership, you ask yourself, what could be an indicator of the kind of leader they could be? Well, it would be nice if you had already been an elder or a deacon. But it turns out there's just not a lot of positions in life where you turn out to be a shepherd or a servant. If any of you have actually been a shepherd, let us know. That might be a great ringing qualification for you. But by and large, we don't appoint literal shepherds or literal household servants to those roles. So how do we find out what kind of person they're going to be in leadership? What we see in the epistles of 1 Timothy and Titus is the closest thing we can find to what leadership will look like in the church is what leadership looks like in the household. And so the household becomes the description or the test of what kind of man this will be in a position of leadership. 1 Timothy 3:4 says it like this: he must manage his own household well. While on the one hand, it's almost impossible to know what sort of an overseer, a servant, or person will be, we can look at how they acted in their home, where in your home, you're quite often in both jobs. Some days you get to feel like overseer. Some days you get to feel like servant, right? And it just kind of depends what day of the week it is. But those are jobs that you'd carry out in a home and that we can look at and gain something from. John Calvin, in his commentary on 1 Timothy, says, the house of a believer ought to be like a little church. That the home, while separate from the church, is the closest thing we can find to what it looks like to manage what we sang this morning, we're part of a family. If we're going to think of this as the household of God, a family of God, the closest thing we can find is a household. And so what Paul gives us, he says, let's take a look at this person and consider what kind of leader or servant this person will be based on how they live in their household. Unfortunately, this rather simple point has been used to launch a half dozen other sub-qualifications, where every detail of that point has been kind of micro-analyzed and scrutinized to the point where there are just a lot of fierce opinions. So before I dive in to give you my round of opinions, I wanted to have a slide about opinions. And let me just comment on that briefly. This is my disclaimer slide. This text about families is very difficult to clearly interpret. And the reason that is because apparently Paul and the Holy Spirit wanted that way. Some of the terms he picks are almost intentionally vague. And I think there's a good reason for that. Every family is different. Every family, case by case, is different. How you manage your household, who does chores, who does this and that, everything about it, the relationship between husband and wife is going to be a little different for every marriage. There are some ground rules, but the actual nuts and bolts of how it works out is never quite the same for any two people. And the same way with how you raise your kids. You know why? Because none of your kids are alike. About the time you get it figured out with number one, God gives you number two and says, surprise, everything's different. None of the same rules apply. So Paul gives a set of criteria that I'm convinced is intentionally vague because of that, because families are so different. You're supposed to look at the family and use these guidelines, this description, to give you some idea of what kind of person this is. The result is all of us, based on our family experience or our think-sos about it, are going to have some opinions, okay? This part of the description begs for opinions, okay? It just asks you to form opinions. And I'll tell you what, that's fine. Opinions are okay. I would expect you to read this text and form some opinions. Just don't confuse your opinions with moral absolutes, where you say, my family was like this, or I think it's best that it be like this. Clearly, to me, Paul meant this, and therefore that's the way everybody has to do it. What we're supposed to do is, with the shared wisdom of the church, read this text about families, and all of us pool our wisdom and knowledge and experience and do the best we can to assess the people we have in front of us. Ultimately, this list is interpreted by the church in keeping with its best wisdom, doing the best it can. So here's what we're going to do this morning. There are a handful of questions that seem like always come up when this passage is discussed in relation to family. I had two choices. One was to completely dodge all of them, which I really thought about. The other was to just dive in headfirst, put it all in one sermon, one bitter pill, we'll swallow it and move on. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at all of the questions related to family in this text, and I'm actually going to try to answer those questions. Not to your satisfaction, to mine. What we're going to do is we're going to look at them, and here's what I'm going to read out every slide. I'm going to put the question at the top. I'm going to put the pertinent verse reference on it. And then I'm going to give you, to the best I can, the information that helped to form my opinion about that text. And then at the bottom, in bold print, with a label, it's going to say, Ben's opinion, so there's no confusion. And then I'm going to tell you what I think. At the end of that, you're allowed to disagree with me. In the same way, I'm allowed to disagree with you because a lot of these texts and the questions we're asking are not clear. But we do eventually have to come to some kind of conclusion because we're going to pick some people, right? That's what every church does. So what I want to do today is just look at these questions, look at these passages. You have an open mind to them and consider them the best we can. Go home and study it on your own, and then we'll pool our wisdom and use it in the best way that we can, because that's the best I can do about it. There's my disclaimer. Let's start with one that'll get me in trouble right off the bat. Chapter 3, verse 11 of 1 Timothy is in the middle of the description of the deacons. So the first seven verses describe the discussion of elders, and then the next five or so verses describe deacons, except for verse 11. And verse 11 says this, "Their wives likewise must be dignified, not slanderers, but sober-minded, faithful in all things." Is this a description or a quality that's assessed of the deacon's wives? When we appoint a man to the role of deacon, are we supposed to also scrutinize his wife to see if she meets the criteria in this passage as well? One logical problem we have with this is there's a description that seems like it's there for the deacon's wives, but there's no correlating point for the elders. And it seems strange, and it has always bothered me. Why would we be so interested in the wife of a deacon and have no opinion about the wife of an elder? In fact, most commentators that read this as a description of a wife will just kind of use a logical trick to say, well, if it's true for the deacons, it's probably true for the elders, and probably everybody's wives should look like this anyway. And so the verse says, again, verse 11, "Their wives likewise must be dignified, not slanderers, but sober-minded, faithful in all things." The catch is, I think there is a simpler explanation of this text, though perhaps not a popular one. The Greek term for wife in this passage is the same Greek term that is used for either women or wives throughout the Bible. If you look in the Bible, it's almost exactly 50-50. I did a verse count. Gynae is almost exactly 50-50. And about half the time it refers to a wife, and about half the time it refers to a woman. And you just have to read the verse and figure out what it's describing. It's not always clear. What I suspect is going on in this passage, in describing the role of deacons, it also becomes clear that there will be various women serving in different capacities in the church. Every church I have ever attended has had women in charge of various responsibilities. I've never been one where that wasn't the case. I dare say if you ever found a place where there were no women doing anything, you would find a dysfunctional church, because they probably keep things moving. They are things that they do and do well, exceptionally well, and every church I have ever been a part of has turned certain assignments over to them, whether it's the children's education program or visitation and special events or other things of that nature. There's quite a lot of things that women do in any church. What I suspect, then, is in the early church, they had the exact same situation. They had some women who were very busy about certain jobs, and they did a great job of them. What kind of woman should be put in charge of different jobs in the church? I think verse 11 is just a description of that. Verse 1 through 7 describes the elders. Verses 8 through 13 describes the deacons. And then verse 11 gives you this side note and says, And the women also, that will serve in various capacities, ought to be this. If you're going to put a lady in charge of something in the church, well, she had better be dignified, not slanderers, sober-minded, faithful in all things. We would not want to put an undignified slanderer in charge of our children's program, or an undignified slanderer in charge of visitation or something like that. It would be completely inappropriate. We know from church history that women were often used in the early church for visitation to widows and other women. Why? Because it became inappropriate at times for a man to visit a woman's house frequently by himself in the middle of the day. It's the kind of thing that people started to talk. And so they would have women who went and visited and attended to them. Paul refers to this particular task in Romans chapter 16, 1 through 2, where he says, "Our sister Phoebe, a servant," this is the Greek term diakonos, same word used here, "a servant of the church at Cenchreae. Welcome her, help her in whatever she may need from you, for she has been a patron of many and of myself as well." This is a woman, he doesn't even tell us what, but she was doing some kind of important work in the church. And Paul says, give her whatever she needs. Help her out. Welcome her. Honor her. She has even been my patron. Apparently, she had helped gather and secure funds for Paul in his travels. Maybe she was a wealthy woman who donated herself, or maybe she went around and pestered everybody until they kicked in some money for Paul. I don't know what she did. But whatever it was, Paul says, honor her. She is a servant of the church. And so I suspect that that's what verse 11 is about. I don't think it's a description of deacons' wives that doesn't also apply to elders' wives. I don't think that's the point. It wouldn't be harmful to use it in that way. Certainly, a person's wife does have a lot of influence over them, and it is worth considering how that influence is going to shape up. But in the context itself, Ben's opinion is that this is probably not a description of wives, but women in works of the church, and what kind of women they ought to be when they're given the various tasks appropriate to them. Next question that comes up related to that, related to wives, is the question of being married. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2 says, "An overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife." Referring to deacons in verse 12, it says, "Let deacons each be the husband of one wife." And if you turn to Titus 1 and verse 6, it says the exact same thing about elders again, that elders are supposed to be the husband of one wife. What I think is being emphasized here is the trait of faithfulness. The person who leads the church is going to have to be faithful to his commitments and to his people that work in that church. He's going to have to care about them when the going gets tough, and it will. I'm performing a wedding ceremony this afternoon, and in the vows I'll say those words that you all know, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, for sickness and in health. Isn't that the life of a church? That the elders are with the church in all of those circumstances. And the question is, has this man demonstrated the quality of faithfulness? If he is not faithful to his wife, how can we expect him to be faithful to the Lord's church? And I think that's the point being made. Also, in the early church, one of the concerns they had related to polygamy, especially when the church moved into North Africa, where there were just some different rules about marriage and so forth, and some of the concerns that were expected. Some of the Jewish people practiced polygamy at this point, though it was rare. Some of the Greek people practiced polygamy at this point, though it was still rare. But in the northern African churches along the coast of the Mediterranean, it was extremely prevalent to see polygamy on a regular basis. And so if you read the early church writers from northern Africa, when they get to 1 Timothy chapter 3, they say, "See, no polygamists," and they use that in that way. But in any event, what it seems to be referring to is, has this person demonstrated the qualities of a husband of one wife that would make him an appropriate candidate for leadership? To get an idea of how this word is used, I would look in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 9. There, describing widows who are enrolled in the church, it says, "Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband." So there's the same description, only with a different verb tense. The widow has been the wife of one husband. She's not now. We understand, and I hope your preacher said this when you got married, "Till death do us part." And marriage is a relationship that extends throughout mortal life, but ends in that. And so this woman who is a widow has been the wife of one husband. The elder is described as being the husband of one wife, which leads me to believe that probably this is simply looking for a man who is currently married to one woman. And that's about the extent of it. It's not a question about his past necessarily. It's a question about, is he at this moment demonstrating that he can be faithful to his spouse in the way that God intended? And so, Ben's opinion, a currently married man can demonstrate faithfulness to his wife. A lot of churches often face this situation, the widower, where maybe even an elder while in service has his wife pass away. And then we ask the question, is he still the husband of one wife? I always tell this story because it's funny and it kind of defuses a lot of tension on it. When I grew up in Seminole, there was a man who was an elder. I mentioned him a couple of weeks ago as the finest elder I've ever known, just a fantastic human being. His wife passed away, and he wanted to step down. He said, I don't think I should be in that capacity as a widower. And they said, well, you've shown us that you can be the husband of one wife. You're, in a sense, still the husband of one wife, so stay on. And they talked him into it. He remarried a few years down the road, and he tried to step down again. They said, why are you stepping down? He said, well, now I'm the husband of two wives. Point is that you can read that and get pretty confused about what it's trying to apply if you get carried away with the verbiage and the language there. And it was a complicated issue that he really struggled with until he ultimately did step down, and he just didn't feel like, given that situation, it was appropriate. I don't have a strong opinion on a widower. I can make a case both ways. In favor of a widower serving, I would say, sure, when a man's wife passes, that wouldn't suddenly change him. The death of another person does not make you less of a leader. However, it could. That would be my point against it. I would say certainly it could. When a person loses a spouse, it is an enormous impact on their life. There is a burden of grief that comes with that that does impact the person. And so there's reason to believe that that would be something you'd want to consider. So I don't have a strong opinion about it. The text is a little bit intentionally vague. I think the church has to look at it and say, does this person meet the qualification of being the husband of one wife? But certainly a currently married man can demonstrate that faithfulness. Regarding the next qualification I want to mention, how many children? In all the text, 1 Timothy 3:4, verse 12, and Titus chapter 1, verse 6, it talks about the leader having children, elders having children. And some folks have read that and said, children's plural, so we've got to have two or three kids, and that's a requirement. I dare say that's not the way we use the word child or children. If today, now we have a second child now, but there for about 5 years, we had one child. And if you had said on a Sunday morning, all the people with children come up to the front and collect a $100 bill, I'd have been in that line. And if you'd have said, you've just got the one, I would still get in that line. That we use especially terms like children as generic terms that include singular or plural in any case, and we don't really fuss about it. In Greek, that's even done more commonly. Neuter plural nouns in Greek often function as a collective. This is pretty typical, and it happens again in this book. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 10, again referring to the care of widows, it says, and having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children and has shown hospitality. Now, no one thinks a widow is somehow less of a widow if she had one child instead of two. I've never seen a church turn away a widow by saying, well, you only have the one child, I'm sorry. That we usually understand that to be a generic term, and we don't read into it a specific plurality. The same thing happens in the Old Testament in the story of Sarah. Sarah, you remember, couldn't have children. And she waited and waited and waited, and she laughed when God said that she would. And then finally she had Isaac. And Isaac, in that story, it says in Genesis 21 and verse 7, it says, who'd have thought that I would have children? Well, you can read that book all the way through. She has exactly one child. But she says, who'd have thought that I would have children? We use that word that way all the time. I don't think a person's ability or decision to have more or less children is necessarily the point of the text. Some would say, well, doesn't dealing with more children prepare you for life in the church more than others? And I'd say, well, maybe. In that case, Zach Tennyson's like the most qualified of us all. And those of us with just two kids, we're kind of barely qualified, just hanging on. But in reality, having one child is actually a lot like being an elder. We had one child for a while, again, before Calvin was born, for about 5 years. And we found often that a single child, while he didn't have a brother to argue with, could manage to be very selfish, very self-consumed and very concerned with his own business. And that's not a bad thing. I just mean that's sometimes what happens to a single child. You know what happens in churches sometimes? Sometimes people can be selfish and self-absorbed, and a one-on-one meeting is required that is very much dealing with a single child. And so I think that's just a psychological observation that some would make, and I don't think it has any validity. All we have is the text. The text says, does he have children? And we use the word children in a variety of ways. So, again, Ben's opinion, any number of children would meet this qualification without question, and I wouldn't fret over that. A harder question relates to having faithful children. This comes from one verse, which is Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, which has been variously translated, just to make us a little more confused, because why not? Titus chapter 1 verse 6 says, if anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife and his children are believers. And the ESV even footnotes that to let you know that there's something going on there, having believing children, believers or faithful children. It's an extremely difficult term to translate. In the pastorals, for example, that same word is used 13 times, and guess what? It's 6 one way and 7 the other. I mean, it's literally as close to 50-50 as you can get. The word there for believer can describe a person who believes something, like a Christian believer. It can also describe a person who is faithful, as in trustworthy. So if you're reading 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, when you read the phrase, this is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptation, that's the word. Now, you wouldn't translate this is a believing saying, because a saying can't believe anything, right? You would say, this is a trustworthy saying. So about half the time in 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, it's translated as trustworthy, and about half the time it's translated as believer or believing, and you're left with that. Couldn't Paul have picked a word that was clearer? This is why, again, I come to the conclusion, Paul, he is a careful dude. You read the writings of Paul, and he knows how to articulate a point clearly. And yet, throughout this section, he keeps using words that are very difficult to put your finger on. And I have to wonder if the Spirit isn't guiding that on purpose. Ultimately, to be trustworthy would be more fitting, in my mind, in the immediate context. And in the parallel context, if you're back in 1 Timothy chapter 3, 4 through 5, this is the parallel to Titus. Titus says, faithful or believing children, but 1 Timothy says this, keeping his children submissive with all dignity. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? And so there, just being dignified and submissive is described, and in the parallel text it says, faithful. Children, remember in the Old Testament, there were certain kind of children who were called rebellious children. And you know what he did with those? The father was allowed to call them into judgment at the city gate. And as in a verse that every kid learned, if your children went to church, your parents went to church often, they would come home and remind you. They used to throw rocks at kids who misbehaved in the Old Testament. Dad reminded me of that quite often. That would be a rebellious child. And Titus spells that out and says, they can't have that kind of child. That would show that a person is not qualified for leadership, but a dignified, obedient, faithful child, a trustworthy child, one who's grown up in some kind of character, that person is qualified. So my think-so is that this describes having respectable children. The question is, throughout the text, how does he manage his household? We believe in free will, and we believe that Christianity is a free will decision. We believe that our parents are not responsible for that decision, don't we? I think it was Jim Pinkston who was telling me the story once of a mission trip to some part of Africa. I can't remember exactly where. But he was describing to me that they went to a very tribal community with a strong family organization. And they were studying with the head of household, the chief, the father of the village. And they convinced him he needed to be baptized. And upon the occasion he decided to be baptized, he got out a whistle. And he blew the whistle. And the rest of the village lined up. And he said, baptize them too. And the missionary says, it's not the way it works. We don't blow a whistle and everybody lines up. We put them in the baptistry. We understand that you're the head of the household and you have responsibility. They're all going to have to think about this too. You don't have absolute control over your children's faith and life. In fact, if you did, we'd say there's something wrong, wouldn't we? We'd say that child hasn't arrived at their own faith. They have only borrowed yours. And when yours run out, they're in trouble. We want children to come to their own conclusion. So I would be very careful about saying for an elder, unless they have impressed upon them Christian faith. And I'll give you one more. I have known a lot of elders. I have known a lot of Christian people who impressed upon their children Christian faith as a way of life so strictly and severely that as soon as they were out of the house, they rebelled against that harshly. So there was a period of time where it looked like, well, what a great Christian man. He's got all his kids coming to church. What a good man. But you don't know what's going on in that home. And then they leave the home and you say, oh, what was going on in that home? And it raises a fair question that maybe that's not as clear a description of a person as we might think. So I think we can look and say, does he have respectable children? Does he manage his household well? That's the description in the text. I would be careful about the others. Obviously, I think it would be ideal if an elder's children have put on Christ. I think that would be a description that would heighten our awareness of his ability to manage his household. I would just be careful about it. Likewise, I've known men who have adopted children and grandchildren in various situations. I've known several whose own children had died and left them with grandchildren. And in that situation, they practiced pure religion, undefiled before God and the Father, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. They took in orphans, exactly like they were supposed to. But these kids were a mess. They had been raised by parents who didn't know what they were doing. It was their kids. And is he now responsible for these grandkids that he's taken in? It just raises a lot of questions. I think you ask, is he raising them respectably? Are they behaving in a way that shows he has a disciplined home? And that's what we're trying to see in this context. Finally. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4 again describes these children as being submissive and dignified. Is this referring to children who still live at home or children who are adult and have grown out of the home? And as I mentioned a moment ago, there can be a great difference in the two when they leave the home. I am convinced again that throughout this text, what you're describing is the description of a well-ordered household. By definition, when a child leaves the home, they're no longer part of your household. Again, I'm performing a marriage ceremony this afternoon, and you know what I'm going to mention? At some point, I'm going to read from Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, where it says, you leave father and mother and cleave to one wife. The definition of marriage is not under that household anymore, but now under another household. That's the definition of a household. And so if the qualification here is what's going on in a person's household, the people who have left it aren't included in that. You can see that in the Old Testament, where virtually all of God's leaders have awful kids. I don't know what they were like when they were at home, but when they grow up, they're terrible. Solomon starts out great. David raised him well until he grew up and became king, and then he's a mess. Eli was a high priest, wonderful man. Then his kids grew up, and guess what they did when they got out of the house? They were a mess, and God kills them. You pick your Old Testament leader, and they pretty much all have children. I don't know what they were like when they were at home, but when they grew up, they became troublesome. They weren't entirely under their control anymore. My dad tried this one on me when I went to college. He says, you're leaving the house, and you're your own man now, but not exactly. And that was his way of saying, I still want to be an influence in your life, but I realize it's something that's changing, and it had to. And that became more pronounced when I became married. And so when I look at this, what I'm looking at is a household. How does this person manage their household? Is he showing the capacity of the leadership in his household? I don't hold him accountable for what his kids do in their household later on down the road. Ben's opinion, this described children that are in the home and whether they are the trustworthy children he ought to have. All right, Ben, what was the point of all of that? Why have these descriptions in here at all? Why bother with this if they are, in fact, open and vague? You may have disagreed with every slide I put up there, and part of my point is that's actually okay, because some of them are 50-50 on word choice. You get Nick down here to read it to you out of Greek, and he'll say, well, it could be this, and it could be that, and that's pretty much what's going to happen anytime you look at this text because of some of the terminology that's used. And we use our judgment. We say, we think it's best if it's this way, but ultimately, it's judgment, and we have to do the best we can. Why bother with it at all? One commentator I looked at that I enjoyed says this, the concept of good management of a household provides the best access to the particular virtues of the supervisor. We notice that only two of the specific qualities point to activities. The supervisor must be hospitable and an apt teacher. Everything else falls into the household category. He says, otherwise, it is the capacity to preside well over a household that is expected to be applied to the life of the church. What this means specifically is the ability to keep one's children behaviorally in good order, literally in subordination, and attitudinally, I looked that up, in all reverence. So when we look at this, we could also summarize this in the words of Paul, which are shorter and use less big words. If someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? So when you read the family descriptions, I think it's part of one description. It's not 10 different unrelated things related to family. It's one point that Paul spells out for himself, so there's no misunderstanding. The question is, does this person's household demonstrate to us that he has the capacity to be a leader and a steward in God's house? Because that's the best indicator we have of what kind of man he will be. There are a lot of different readings of that, and I encourage you to study it on your own, but that's all I got, and that's the best I can do. We are blessed to be part of a family of God. We are blessed to be part of a family that is overseen by elders and served by deacons who do care for us like a family. And I would invite every person here to be part of that family by faith and obedience, putting your faith in Christ and being baptized into him for the remission of sins, to begin a life in his family and in his service. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If we can help you in any way, won't you come?